Good evening. I'm Paul Craik, the RSA's Programme Director. It's my pleasure to welcome you to what promises to be a very interesting evening indeed. Before I start, a couple of housekeeping notes. Please could you turn off your mobile phones. If the fire alarm sounds, we need to evacuate the building by either of the two marked fire exits, and we muster on the opposite side of John Adams Street. Tonight's lecture has been organised in association with the Royal Institution and with Allen Lane Publishers. We're very grateful to both of those for their help. I should tell you now that this event is being live audio streamed over the RSA's website. Almost all our lectures are now audio streamed, so if you're unable to come, you can listen in the privacy of your own home. Or you can download an MP3 file of the lecture and play it repeatedly to your heart's content. I need to apologise on behalf of Polly Toynbee. The more observant of you will have noticed that Polly was down to chair this evening. Unfortunately, she's indisposed and is unable to join us. I'm delighted to be able to tell you that Madeleine Bunting from The Guardian has agreed to stand in at ridiculously short notice to chair this evening's discussion. We're extremely grateful to her. I'll pop up again at the end of the evening to tell you about the RSA's bar and also book signing arrangements. You'll be pleased to hear that you will be able to get your book signed. Now, all that remains is for me to ask you to join me in formally welcoming both Madeleine Bunting and our two distinguished speakers, the Reverend Professor Alistair McGrath and Professor Daniel Dennett. Welcome.
Thank you very much, and thank you for that warm welcome. And there's a very good reason why I raced to get here tonight, which is I've spent a fascinating 2 hours this morning with Dan Dennett and found the conversation enormously enlightening. We don't agree on everything, but there's a very fruitful discussion, I think, to be had. And I'm delighted to meet Alistair, who I've had a very, very interesting email correspondence with. So for me, I feel this evening is going to be a very, very interesting event, and I so wanted to be here to hear this conversation that I turned everything around to get here. So I think we've got a great treat ahead of us. I'll just very briefly, I probably don't need to introduce Dan Dennett in any great detail to many of you. He's written a series of remarkable books which have gained great respect in many parts of the world, including his home country, America. His latest book, I think, is a hugely important contribution to the American public culture and must be seen in that context. So I think it's very, very kind of, in some ways, it's quite a difficult one for the English reader to find their way into the book. And I find it fascinating to hear him talking about the particular context of America. So Dan Dennett is a professor of philosophy at Tufts University. He's written a number of books, Consciousness Explained, Freedom Evolves, and he lives in North Andover, Massachusetts, and has a farm in Maine. That's what I learnt this morning, which I thought sounded really amazing. Alistair is perhaps one of the most prominent Christian scientists in the UK. He has also written a number of deeply respected books. A former atheist, he became a Christian and has doctorates in both natural sciences and Christian theology. And he has carried out research on molecular biophysics at Oxford and is currently Professor of Historical Theology at Oxford University. So the plan for this evening is that Dan will speak for about 20 minutes, Alistair for about 20 minutes, and then we'll have some time for comments and questions, the part that I will chair. So I think we'll go straight over to Dan.
Thank you.
Are we supposed to move up the platform?
Thank you very much, Madeleine. Can we get to my slides? There we go. Yes. Let me say a word about the title of the book. If I told you that I wanted to study the pharmaceutical industry because it was a very important industry these days. After all, if we live through the threat of bird flu, it'll be because of wonderful things that are happening in the pharmaceutical industry. I think most people would say, yes, by all means, study it with all the intensity you can muster. It may make a few people uncomfortable, but it certainly we should make sure we do it right. If I said in exactly the same tone of voice, and I think while we're at it, we should also study organized religions with the same intensity, because they're very important factors in the world today. A lot of people would sort of draw back in horror and say, you mustn't do that. It's just not done. It's blasphemous. It's sacrilegious. It's rude. To which I want to say, well, that may be, but we're going to have to do it. And that's the spell that I want to break. The taboo against subjecting religion to the same level of scientific scrutiny that we address all other really important phenomena to. So that's the meaning of the title. Now, the British edition has this picture of me on the cover, and I noticed that a lot of people have been sort of remarking at this sort of strange resemblance between me and one of my heroes. I really don't know what this is about. I don't know why they say it, but it's really coincidental, in fact. I'd already had the beard for 10 years before I read The Selfish Gene. So it isn't deliberate in any case. But now I want to turn directly, in the little time that's available to me, to a very brief account of what's in my book. And I'm going to start. Oh, my goodness, this is out of order. Well, that'll do. Here we go. There we go. What is this? What we have here is, of course, a dairy cow. And the question is, who designed it? Who designed the dairy cow? And the answer, of course, is, well, the dairy cow was designed for millions of years, you might say, by natural selection all by itself. It was a wild species. This is the aurochs, which is the ancestor of the dairy cow. And at that point, the aurochs, what was it for? It was just for itself. Aurochs were for making more aurochs. But then, when the aurochs became domesticated, it came eventually under conscious, deliberate, one might even say intelligent design. Breeders who were set on taking this beast and turning it into something for human purposes, redesigning it, optimizing it in various ways, in effect reverse engineering the cow and engineering the cow into something for human purposes. And what I want to say is that much the same thing is true of religions. Religions haven't existed on the planet forever. They are, in fact, a quite recent phenomenon. In fact, organized religions are more recent than the domestic cow. That they evolved from wild ancestors, and that they're still evolving, and that if we want to understand religions, we need to subject them to very careful scientific scrutiny. Religions are brilliantly designed products. It's no wonder that religions have the hold over us that they do. They've been designed and redesigned for thousands of years by human beings and for tens of thousands of years and more by evolution, by natural selection. They have an evolutionary history, which we should try to get to the bottom of as best we can, and we can. So in other words, what I'm talking about is reverse engineering religions. Looking under the hood to see what makes them work, trying to figure out how the features that they have got the way they got. Some of them are the products of intelligent human re-engineering. Some of them are the products of essentially blind human tinkering, like early domestication. And some of them are more ancient still and really owe their existence not to any human engineering at all, but to the engineering that's done by evolution, by natural selection. With a phenomenon as remarkable as religion, but also as familiar to us as religion, it helps to get a little distance, to make the familiar strange. And so one of the things I try to do in my book is let's be Martians. Let's be Martian biologists who arrive on this planet and are rather struck by a number of phenomena. And I want to draw your attention to a few phenomena that might really fascinate a Martian biologist, just because they're surprising. Now, what on earth is this? Would anybody like to hazard a guess of what this is? Is it a whale? No, it's not a whale. Is it a tongue? No, it's not a tongue. Is it something in a petri dish? Is it bacteria? No. Any other guesses? It is, in fact, a satellite image of approximately 1 million people gathered on the banks of the Ganges River in 2001. That would impress Martian biologists. Goodness gracious, look at all those vertebrates, all those hominids gathered in one place. What on earth is this about? Other things that would impress the biologists is this crowd in St. Peter's Square or this crowd in Mecca. What would impress the biologists from Mars is that these are tremendous expenditures of time, energy, money. They are incredibly robust phenomena. And the question is, what on earth is going on here? How did all this originate? That's one question the Martians would want to know. What is it for? How does it perpetuate itself? And they would be quite sure that all of these questions have good answers, whether or not we can get to those answers, because one of the lessons of biology is that nothing this robust and this expensive happens just by chance. It's not just an accident. Something, in effect, has to pay for this biologically, and we have to get to the bottom of that. Here's another thing that might really impress you or a Martian biologist. Go out in the meadow and you see an ant climbing a blade of grass. And you watch this ant to see what he's doing, and he's climbing and climbing and climbing. And you think, what's this ant doing? And he keeps climbing. If he falls, he climbs again. If he falls, he climbs again. This is Sisyphus rolling his rock. What is going on here? He climbs until he gets to the very top of the blade of grass. You think, well, what benefit accrues to the ant here? What's this all for? Is he hunting for food? Is he lost? Is he showing off to potential mates? What benefit accrues to the ant from all of this activity? And that turns out to be the wrong question. No benefit accrues to the ant, none at all. What, you mean, is it just a fluke? Well, yes, it is just a fluke. It's a lancet fluke. Dicrocelium dendriticum is a small parasitic brain worm that has to get into the belly of a sheep or a cow to continue its reproductive cycle. So what it does is it commandeers a passing ant and hops into its brain and drives it like an all-terrain vehicle up the blade of grass to improve its chances of being eaten by a cow or a sheep. And the salmon swim upstream to find the places they have to go to spawn, to lay their eggs. Dicrocelium dendriticum simply hops into a brain of a passing ant and lets the ant do all the hard work. This is pretty spooky. Here we have a hijacker, a parasite that infects the brain and induces suicidal behavior on behalf of a cause other than one's own genetic fitness. Does anything like that ever happen to us? Ugh. Well, I'd like to point out to you that the Arabic word Islam means submission. It means surrender of self-interest to the will of Allah. But Islam is not alone in this. This is a not very good photograph of a parchment page that I found in a Paris bookstall about 50 years ago. And what it says is, Semen est verbum Dei sator autem Christus. Omnis creatus eum manebit in eternum. It's very nice to those of us who like memes and mutations, is that Christus, you may notice here, right, just about in the middle, is written with a chi and a rho, so it's a mixture of Greek and Latin, and then whoever is the scribe is doesn't know that the rho is an R and has written an R after the chi and rho. So this is a nice little instance of the mindless copying that's going on in this case. Well, what does this mean? It means the word of God is a seed and the sower of the seed is Christ. Now, that's not quite as perhaps as shocking an image, the image of the word as a seed as opposed to the word as a parasite that commandeers the host. But in fact, many in Christianity embrace that latter image as well. Consider these words. The heart of worship is surrender. Surrendered people obey God's word even if it doesn't make sense. Where did those phrases come from? They came from the recent book by Pastor Rick Warren, The Purpose-Driven Life. So it's not that Christians abhor the message, the image of themselves as selfless servants of an idea that has attached itself to them. They actually glory in it. They celebrate this idea. And in fact, I want to point out that we all celebrate this idea, religious and secular alike. Because there are, in fact, many ideas to die for, not just Islam and Christianity. Think of all the people in the 20th century who sacrificed their lives to further the well-being of the idea of communism. They were making a terrible mistake, but they certainly devoted their lives to it. Or democracy. Probably everybody in this room has a relative who gave up his or her life to further this cause. Or justice. Or freedom. I live in Massachusetts. Just to the north of Massachusetts is the state of New Hampshire. Each state has its own license plate. This is New Hampshire's. Live free or die. That is the motto of the state of New Hampshire. The moose cannot reflect on this. The moose cannot have this idea. Consider, is maximizing your progeny the summum bonum of your life? I don't think so. How many of you think that the most important thing in life is having more grandchildren than your neighbors? Not a single hand goes up. I'd like to point out to you, we're the only species on the planet of which that is true. This is a remarkable biological fact about us, is that we are in a position to replace our genetic imperative with other imperatives. It's something we do. It's a remarkable thing that we do. It is the key to our civilization. And it is, of course, itself the gift of human culture. It's because we have language, it's because we have culture, that we have achieved this remarkable independence from our genetic imperatives. It's ideas, not worms, that hijack our brains. Ideas that can replicate, that can be passed from brain to brain. They're what Richard Dawkins has called memes. His book, The Selfish Gene, is just now 30 years old. And in that book, he suggests that human culture consists of items which are analogous to genes in important ways. Or to viruses, which, like cultural items, are not alive, but manage to provoke their own replication when they get in the right place. Well, what is a virus, really? I have a definition of this, which, by the way, has recently been picked up by some biologists who say, exactly right. What a virus is a string of nucleic acid with attitude. It's not alive, it doesn't have a brain, it doesn't have a mind. It just has something about it which provokes its own replication when it gets in a cell. Ideas can do that too. And the ideas of religion are the ones that I want to talk about. And I'm going to talk about them. I realize I've just about used up my time. Here's a nice quote I found in a theologian. If survival of the fittest has any validity as a slogan, then the Bible seems a fair candidate for the accolade of the fittest of texts. Not the truest, not the best, not necessarily just the fittest. In the legitimate biological sense, it's had the most offspring. There are more copies of the Bible around than any other text. In that sense, it's fit. It says nothing about whether it's good for our fitness. But who cares? Anyway, none of us care about our biological fitness. You just admitted that. There's not a person in this room that thinks that their biological fitness is worth worrying about. We all have other axes to grind. We all have other projects that we think are more important. We're all prepared to devote our lives, and maybe even to die, for one idea or another, not our genes. And human culture is itself one of the fruits on the tree of life. Now, in my book, I give a sketch of a sketch of how this happened, the evolution of human culture, and particularly the evolution of religion. And I'm not going to, because I've run out of time just about, I'm not going to go into it here beyond to say that it starts with a hyperactive agent detection device, which is your capacity, your disposition, when you see something you don't understand, to say, who's there and what do you want? To look for agents in the world, more agents than in fact there are. So we begin to populate our minds with imps and goblins, fairies, gods, leprechauns, all sorts of invisible agents. That's not religion, that's just superstition. But this is what religion evolves out of, superstition. They compete for rehearsal space in individual brains. And I want to ask the question, what are the winners for? The reason I ask this question is that when people hear, oh, you've got an evolutionary theory of religion, do you? Oh, good. I've always wondered what religions are for. I'm sure they're good for us somehow, because after all, every human group that has ever been studied has had religion, so it must be good for something. What is it? And I say, well, you might be right, but not so fast. Every human group that has ever been studied also has the common cold. What's it for? It's for itself. And it survives because it can. And we have to start there. This is the neutral way to begin. What the winners are for is for occupying the minds they find themselves in. That's all they're for at first. Now, let me reinforce this with a little riddle. How are spoken words and folk songs like squirrels, rats, pigeons, and barn swallows? And the answer is, these species are wild, not domesticated, but they have evolved by natural selection to live in our proximity, to depend on us in spite of our not caring for them. We are not their stewards. We are not their owners. They are not domesticated, but they have been evolved. They have evolved to exploit features of us. The same thing is true, I claim, of spoken words, folk songs, and what I call folk religions. What are they for? They're for themselves. They happen because they can. But now let's consider sheep. How clever a sheep it was that they acquired shepherds. What a good move. In one stroke, they could outsource all their problems, their protection from predators, their food finding, their health maintenance, all at a cost of a loss of free mating. And it was a tremendous fitness boost to them. There are millions and millions, hundreds of millions of sheep in the world today. Very few of their closest relatives survive in the wild at all. Of course, they did pay the price of having smaller brains. And as we know, sheep are actually very stupid. It wasn't the sheep's cleverness at all. Well, whose cleverness was it then? Ah, this is where Francis Crick's joke about Orgel's second rule comes in. Evolution is cleverer than you are. Notice this is not intelligent design. Francis Crick would not assert that intelligent design is true. What he is saying is evolution, the process, is mindless and stupid and purposeless, but the designs that it comes up with are breathtakingly brilliant, ingenious beyond description. The products are brilliant, the process is not. And it is the process of evolution that is responsible for the cleverness of these moves. What I want to say is that the wild means of religion got themselves domesticated. They acquired stewards who were prepared to devote their lives to their flourishing. Once the means of religion become domesticated, now they're for something. Auroxes were just for auroxes, for making more auroxes. But dairy cattle are for us. We own them. And once domesticated God memes came into existence, we could start thinking about what they might be useful for. I've run out of time, so I will just mention a few things that everybody knows about. No, everybody doesn't know about Julian Jayne's brilliant idea that memes are basically, that religious God memes are basically, one of the main purposes of them is to help us with decision making. He imagines that it was very hard for people to make up their mind, and they needed a sort of super-duper coin flipper to convince them to stick to a decision once they'd made it. And they hit upon many methods, basically consisting of ask the gods what to do and the gods will tell you. You don't have to understand why it works. You're still the beneficiary. It makes you more resolute, and it might actually be better than a coin flip. Doesn't have to be. It makes you resolute. Whereas placebo effect props, I won't go into that. It's an interesting story, but I go there because I want to remind you of everybody's favorite, which is a surrogate police. The story they tell about a little town in Maine where when you enter the town, there's a sign saying, you know, welcome to Brooksville. And then there's another sign which says, your speed controlled by radar. And somebody asked one of the selectmen, says, gee, that must be pretty expensive. He said, no, it costs about $5. What? You know, now I got a piece of plywood and I painted it and I wrote the sign. That's all. You don't actually have to have the radar. You just have to have the sign that says speed controlled by radar. So that's certainly one of the uses that God memes have been put to. So my claim in the book is that organized religions descended from folk religions, which were wild. And when we became conscious, deliberate stewards of our ideas, this changed everything. Here's a famous case, the cuckoo chick. It doesn't know what it's doing, but it's the beneficiary. Cuckoos, as you know, are parasites. And the first thing they do when they hatch is they try to push all the other eggs out of the nest. It's very purposive, but they don't understand why they're doing it. But the rationale is unmistakable. It's what I call a free-floating rationale. It's Mother Nature's rationale. It's in order to maximize the food intake of the parasite, and the host birds will come and feed it. The chick has a tiny little brain. The chick doesn't understand this at all. Many of the memes of organized religion, many of the adaptations of organized religion are like this, in that the people who engage in these behaviors are completely innocent. They don't understand why they're doing what they're doing. They have no evil intent, but the strategies they're employing nevertheless have very powerful effects in preserving their religion in the face of contest. There's one big difference, and this is the one I want to point out. When we become stewards of our religious memes, because we have those big reflective brains, we can understand these rationales. The cuckoo chick can't be embarrassed or ashamed, but a human being can. And one of the points of my book is to show some of the adaptations for organized religion that have arisen and draw to people's attention the fact that they have rationales that may not be entirely as presentable as they thought. Who benefits? When folk religions became organized religions, there was a shift from the free-floating rationales to the represented rationales. The rationales of the stewards were responsive to other goals, to represented goals, like the goals of those people that domesticated the cow and the sheep and all the other animals. I'm just about at the end here. I think, in fact, maybe this is a good point to stop because I've actually used up more than my time. I'll just mention one more. Belief in belief. This is my favorite part of the book. Some people believe in God. Some people believe in belief in God. And I want to point out, more people believe in belief in God. Really? Sure. All the people who believe in God, with very few exceptions, also believe in belief in God. What's that? If you believe in belief in God, you think belief in God is a really good thing. It's really important that people believe in God. I hope everybody believes in God. I hope I continue believing in God. That's what it is to believe in belief in God. So everybody who, to a first approximation, who believes in God also believes in belief in God. And then we have all the people who've lost their faith, but who still believe in belief in God, who regret that they've lost their faith, who are embarrassed, who are ashamed, who are hoping to recover their belief in God. And it turns out that belief in God is not playing the role that it used to. The big social role today is played by belief in God. And that changes everything. On that note, I think I should stop. Thank you very much for your attention. Okay.
I'd like to begin by thanking Professor Dennett for writing such a marvellous book by getting a very good discussion underway. And in 20 minutes, obviously, all I can do is pick up some points. I wish I had more time, but I think he's given us a lot to think about. I've called this lecture The Spell of the Meme. Why hasn't religion died out? I mean, that, I think, is a central question. As many of you will know, a few months back, the World Congress of the International Academy of Humanism took place in upstate New York. And its organizers, I think, had no doubt of the urgency of their theme. Religion is regaining the ascendancy. Humanity is facing a new dark ages. And their speakers were trying to work out how on earth they could get rid of the God delusion, one of the many barriers that need to be swept away if humanity is finally to come of age. And I think it's a fascinating glimpse of the crisis of confidence that I see gripping atheism at the moment. As Guardian columnist Madeleine Bunting, who is with us tonight, pointed out when commenting on a recent TV program, there seems to be a loss of faith of some sort going on here. She writes, "Behind unsubstantiated assertions, sweeping generalizations, and random anecdotal evidence, there's the unmistakable whiff of panic. They fear religion is on the march again." I think you can see what Madeleine means, that, I mean, belief in God was meant to have died out years ago. When I myself was an atheist back in the late 1960s, everything seemed so simple. A bright new dawn lay just round the corner, religion would be relegated to the past, a grim and dusty relic of a bygone age. And God was just a kind of cozy illusion for losers, best left to very inadequate and very sad people. Just a matter of time, waiting for nature to take its course. Now, of course, I was in very good company in believing this sort of thing. I think it was the smug, foolish, and fashionable wisdom of the age. And like flared jeans, it was accepted enthusiastically, if just a little uncritically. I arrived at Oxford from School of Marxists, believing that religion was the cause of all the world's evils. And as an intellectual Darwinian, it seemed to me obvious that the idea of God was on its way out, and they would be replaced by fitter and more adapted ideas like Marxism. I was a bright, to use Professor Dennett's language. But it didn't work out like that. At Oxford, to my surprise, I discovered Christianity. It was the intellectually most exhilarating and spiritually stimulating thing I could ever hope to describe, better even than chemistry, a wonderful subject that I had thought to be the love of my life and my future career. I went on to gain a doctorate for research in molecular biophysics from Oxford and found that, you know, really good. But I knew I had found something better, like the pearl of great price that Jesus talks about in the Gospel, which is so beautiful, so precious, that overshadows everything. It is intellectually satisfying, imaginatively engaging, and aesthetically exciting. But obviously that raised some questions for me, because I'd been taught that science disproved God, that all good scientists were atheists, that science was good and religion was evil. It was a hopelified, simplified, binary opposition, of course, not unlike George Orwell and Animal Farm, four legs good, two legs bad. But it suited me just fine then. Yet my newfound Christian faith brought a new sense of fulfillment and appreciation to my studies and later my research in the sciences. I found that belief in God gave a new direction, a new animus, a new impetus to my investigation of nature. I gave up the sciences to read theology, but I still love them and try to keep up in the literature. And above all, I have a passion for trying to relate Christian theology to the natural sciences, and hence, I suppose, my presence here tonight. So I turn now to engage Professor Dennett. An excellent book, lots to talk about, only time to talk about some things. The first point that Professor Dennett made that got me nodding my head in agreement comes very early in the book. People sometimes feel very defensive about religion. Religious people often get very defensive when challenged about the basis of their beliefs, and very often that does hinder any serious debate about the nature of faith. I think he's right there, and I know precisely what he means. I suspect the issue really is that a challenge to faith often threatens to pull the rug from under the values and beliefs that have sustained someone's life. But that, I think, is a general problem with any significant worldview, and not just a religion. I gave a lecture last year, I gave many of these, on the religious views of Richard Dawkins. And it's fairly standard stuff. I argued that Dawkins' atheism was not adequately grounded in argument or evidence, and represented a very skewed reading of natural sciences. Afterwards, I was confronted by a very angry man, who told me I had destroyed his faith. His atheism had rested on the authority of Richard Dawkins, and I had thrown his life into turmoil. Now, part of me, I suspect the unregenerate part of me, felt that I was just too bad, and that he ought to have been more critical about evaluating evidence. But another part of me noted that some beliefs, not all, but some beliefs, matter so much to us that we base our lives upon them. We all need to examine our beliefs, Professor Dennett is right, especially if we are naive enough to think that we don't have any. So how, I wondered, would Professor Dennett clarify the distinction between a worldview and a religion? The distinction is notoriously imprecise, and many would say it's constructed by those who have some vested interest to defend. And here I must confess some puzzlement. Professor Dennett tells us that, I quote, "A religion without God or gods is like a vertebrate without a backbone." Now, if I were leading a sixth form discussion about how we might define religion, that would be the first definition to be considered, and I need to say, the first to be rejected, because it is so inadequate. What about non-theistic religions? Vertebrates, by definition, have backbones. The concept of religion does not entail God. So why that definition? I initially thought it was because Professor Dennett has American Protestant fundamentalism in his gun sights. It's a very glowy American book, as Madeline was hinting. But after I'd finished reading the book, I think I could see another explanation. If I've understood him correctly, Professor Dennett wants to explain religion in terms of evolutionary theory, and above all, the idea that belief in God confers some kind of survival advantages. So religions that don't believe in God don't really fit that bill. Very briefly, I have to say very simply, that I was not persuaded by his account of what religion is. I think most religious people would find it actually quite difficult to relate to. Perhaps I wonder it might tell us more about what leading figures in America's political and intellectual left think about religion, which I think is a rather more different and possibly more interesting matter. So let me now turn to what I think is the most interesting aspect of this book, its appeal to science. That's an area that excites me, and Professor Dennett's earlier book, Darwin's Dangerous Idea, shows that he has mastered some of the intellectual issues that he'd need to address in this book. And I would place Professor Dennett, broadly speaking, in the naturalist explanation of religion, which includes Ludwig Feuerbach, Karl Marx, Sigmund Freud. Whatever the benefits of religions might be, and there are some, Professor Dennett and these writers would argue that they arise entirely inside human minds. No spiritual realities exist outside us. Natural explanations may be given of the origins of belief in God. Now, I hesitate to mention this, but this does rather seem to be a circular argument that presupposes its conclusions. So, what models does Professor Dennett propose for the origins of faith in God? And I was delighted to find a rich range of explanatory approaches in this book. One is the sweet tooth theory. On this approach, just as we have evolved a receptor system for sweet things, so in a similar way, we might have a God center in our brains. Such a center might depend on a mystical gene that was favored by natural selection because people with it tend to survive better. Just a moment, I thought, where's the science? Where's the evidence for this? Instead, I found mights and maybes, speculation and supposition, instead of what I would hope for, which is evidence-driven and evidence-based argumentation. And at points I did feel that these theories are evidence-free and somewhat speculative. For example, we were told a moment ago, that religious ideas could have spread from individual superstitions via shamanism and the early wild forms of strains of religion. Very interesting. But the evidence I'd like to see. I don't really see, for example, enough engagement with the history of religions, above all Christianity, which is plenty of history. Reminds me of some of those TV ads, "This could help you lose weight," as part of a calorie-controlled diet. Could. The TV ad writers would love to be able to say their product was clinically proven to do these things, but they don't, because the evidence really isn't there. Now, obviously, I wish I had time to do justice to Professor Dennett and to engage with each of the major models that I noted in working through this book, and sadly, I just don't have time. So what I want to do, if I may, is focus on the one I think is the strongest, and that indeed was the one Professor Dennett mentioned most in his presentation, which is the idea of the meme, a hypothetical cultural or intellectual replicator. And with this model, as you heard, religions might be memes that infect our brains. They're not necessarily parasitic, but they could be symbiotic, conferring advantages on those who are infected. So let's think about this. Is belief in God a meme? It's an idea that Richard Dawkins floated back in 1976, and it lingers to this day. And I remember when I first came across this idea back in 1977, I was very excited by it, because I was beginning my career as an intellectual historian, and I felt that this might be a rigorous science-based approach to cultural intellectual development that would actually aid my investigations. Others I know felt the same. But as I began to check this one out, it didn't really help me at all. It just didn't work. And after 10 years focusing especially on intellectual developments in the late Renaissance, I came to the conclusion it didn't work. But the real problems are far deeper. The meme is just an hypothesis. One I would want to argue that we simply don't need, because there are better models available, for example, in economics or in anthropology. If we couldn't see genes, we'd have to invent them. The evidence demands a biologically transmitted genetic replicator. But memes cannot be observed, and the evidence can be explained perfectly well without them. As Maurice Bloch, who's professor of anthropology at LSE, commented recently, I quote, "The exasperated reaction of many anthropologists to the general idea of memes reflects the apparent ignorance of the proponents of the meme hypothesis of the discipline of anthropology and its major successes in the explanation of cultural development without feeling the need to develop anything like the meme at all." So at this stage in my argument, the issue is simply whether memes exist, irrespective of their implications for religion. I would argue that many scientists, in fact possibly most, are skeptical about them. As Simon Conway Morris, who's professor of evolutionary paleobiology at Cambridge, pointed out, memes seem to have no place in serious scientific reflection. I quote, "Memes are trivial, to be banished by simple mental exercises. In any wider context, they are hopelessly, if not hilariously, simplistic." Now, in reading this book, I have to confess I was puzzled that the arguments of such leading critics of memetics were not identified and confronted point by point. And my concern is that this book, in my view, makes a critique of religion dependent on a hypothetical, unobserved entity which can be dispensed with completely to make sense of what we observe. Isn't that actually a core atheist critique of God, an unobserved hypothesis that we can dispense with easily in matters of explanation? If I were an atheist, I would want to drop this memetic approach altogether, which I think simply weakens your case, and head back to the safer territory of Marxist dialectical reading of history, which in my view is much more intellectually rigorous and evidence-driven. But far be it for me, as a lapsed atheist, to tell those of you who still believe how to do your job. Anyway, what do memes actually do? Professor Dennett tells us they spread beliefs like beliefs in God. So, are all beliefs spread by memes, or just the ones that anti-religious critics don't like? Is there a meme for atheism? Professor Dennett offers us a simple taxonomy of memes. On the basis of that, I think they might. And since there is no compelling scientific evidence for these things anyway, is there a meme for believing in memes? Now that seems to me to be a real problem. Maybe belief in God is caused by memes. What about atheism? Anyone familiar with intellectual history will spot the pattern immediately. My ideas are exempt from the general pattern I observe for other people's ideas, so they're explained away. And I worry slightly that Professor Dennett heads in that direction at one or two points. Let me ask this question once more. Is it just belief in God that is a meme? Surely atheism is as well. Now, I emphasize that point because last month I debated Susan Blackmore, England's most able defender today of the meme hypothesis, at the Oxford Union, a debate on the meme. And we had a great time talking about every aspect of this, and I put precisely that point to her. Is atheism a meme? Her response was immediate and enthusiastic. Yes, it is. So I want to ask the question. Is Dr. Blackmore wrong when she affirms atheism is a meme? Because if so, you can see surely all viewpoints are affected in the same way, whether religious or anti-religious. Which, I wonder, is mimetic orthodoxy and which is mimetic heresy? The same way as belief in God. And I would argue with equally negative consequences. But my real question is actually this. How would Dr. Blackmore and Professor Dennett be able to settle that particular point scientifically? If they are not able to do so, then we have a non-scientific debate about imaginary entities hypothesized by analogy with the gene. And we all know how unreliable arguments based on analogy can be. Witness, for example, the fruitless search for the luminiferous ether in the late 19th century based on a hypothesized analogy between light and sound. It was analogically plausible, but it was non-existent. The analogy was simply invalid. Richard Dawkins tells us that memes are merely awaiting their Crick and their Watson. I think they are merely waiting for their Michelson and Morley. Finally, I was glad to see Professor Dennett and I have so much in common. We both love democracy. We both love freedom, science, and lots of other things we can explore later. We both also abhor violence and oppression. And Professor Dennett in this book argues that religion has on occasion encouraged both of those. And I agree with him. That's a fact of history. Yet one of the things I most regret about this book is that it excoriates religionists for their contributions to conflict and violence down the centuries, but doesn't note atheism's failures in precisely those areas. I searched in vain for even a mention of Lenin or Stalin, each of whom launched violent programs of repression based on their atheist worldviews against Christianity and Islam. That's a fact of history as well. Now, Professor Dennett might respond, and in fact, I think he would respond, by saying that these are not typical of atheism. And I believe he'd be entirely right to make that response. But neither are the excesses of violence and intolerance that he does mention in the book typical of religion. One simply cannot represent the pathological elements of any movement, whether religious or anti-religious, as if they were normal or typical. Few of us in this audience tonight are in favor of fanaticism, but it's clearly possible to be a fanatical atheist as much as a fanatical religionist. It's fanaticism that seems to me to be the problem, not so much religion or indeed anti-religion. In Oxford at this moment, we are indeed facing a threat from one of the most fanatical groups in British society today, animal rights protesters. They are not religious. They are driven by an ideology, by a worldview. Surely, it seems to me, our common enemy is the fanatic, first and foremost. But it's a clear factual error to assume that this is limited to or necessarily characteristic of religion. I must end. And I do so by repeating my thanks to Professor Dennett for writing this book and my apologies to him and indeed to you for only being able to engage so briefly with so few themes in this book. I believe it helps move the debate about the place of religion into a new and more helpful place, and look forward to our interaction on these themes. Thank you.
Well, that was absolutely terrific. I think it would be the right thing to do for Dan to have a chance to respond perhaps to some of Alistair's points, if we could perhaps have a few comments before we open it out.
Sure. First of all, Alistair, you're pounding on an open door. Yes, of course, scientific ideas are memes, and atheism is a meme. Yes, that's not the point. The point is not to criticize anything by calling it a meme. On the contrary, it's to provide an explanatory basis. So, yes, of course, Dr. Blackmore was right to say, yes, of course, atheism is a meme. How many of you think there are words? How many of you think that words are in your ontology? You believe in words? Or are you not so sure that words exist? I think words exist, but if you think about them, they're extremely puzzling. What are they made of? They're not sounds. They're not made of ink. It turns out that the concept of a word is a very abstract. We're so familiar to us that we don't tend to realize just how strange words are as a category. If you believe in words, then you believe in memes, because words are memes that can be pronounced. Then there's the memes that can't be pronounced, like fashions and other behaviors, and then there's large complexes of memes. The existence of memes is not in doubt at all. The importance of a theory of memetics is still to be debated. Now, Alistair is right that, and he cites two, Morris Bloch and Simon Conway Morris, who have expressed their dislike of the concept of memes. Have I dealt with them? Yes. Are they serious critics? No. In neither case, in particular, I think Morris Bloch's animadversions against memes are thoughtful but distinctly answerable, and I think I've dealt with them in several. My book has several appendices that deal with the objections to memes, and I think that there one finds good answers to the best criticisms by the anthropologist Dan Sperber and his colleagues, for instance, and others. So the idea that what you've heard is a sort of reductio ad absurdum of memes is, I think, just absurd. You haven't heard a reductio ad absurdum of memes. The concept survives quite well for another day. He says correctly that he finds in my book much speculation, much hypotheses, and not much evidence. Well, there's some evidence, and I say very explicitly throughout the book, this is just a sketch of a theory so that you can see what it would be like to have a natural theory, a theory of religion as a natural phenomenon. I explicitly say I don't claim to have proved any of this. If you don't like my theory, replace it with another one that's better, one that is better supported by evidence. I give a sketch of what I think to be the best hypotheses that have been devised so far, and I do talk about the evidence for them, and there is actually significant evidence for them. I don't claim to have confirmed any of it. That's the point of the book, is to call for more research, including research that doesn't make use of the concept of memes. The main importance to me of the concept of memes is precisely to get away from the otherwise extremely attractive position, which he actually mentioned, that if religions have survived and are so dominant in human life, it must be because they aid our survival. Maybe, maybe not. If you assume that at the outset, you're not being objective. They may aid our survival. They may only survive. They may survive as sort of unshakable habits. If you resist that hypothesis at the outset, you're not doing objective science. The way to find an objective standpoint from which to investigate the hypotheses is to acknowledge that cultural items can spread whether or not they're good for us. Graffiti, spray can graffiti, pornography, all sorts of dubious or fashions. You don't have to suppose that they're good for us to look at them with an evolutionist's eye. Some of them are wonderful forces, absolutely no doubt about it. Maybe some of the means of religion are really good for us. That is an open question which we can explore scientifically. What about non-theistic religion? Alistair cites my definition, my point that a religion without God or gods is like a vertebrate without a backbone. As I go on to say, I'm quite prepared to look at vertebrates without backbones, to look at what might be called former religions. I just need a definition for the sake of argument, and I choose to include the presence of a belief in supernatural agents as key, as core to my definition of a religion. But I'm quite prepared to also to look at what I would, in fact, submit that given that definition of a religion, then there are a lot of things which call themselves religions today that aren't really religions. Why do they call themselves religions? Well, for one thing, because you can get wonderful tax breaks if you call yourself a religion. Scientology wasn't called a religion at the outset. It's a religion now because it gets a great deal from the government by being a religion. It doesn't have any gods. Many people have, in effect, given up the supernatural agents. They're non-theistic, but they still want to cling to the prestige of calling this a religion. There may be very good reasons for doing that, but let's not kid ourselves. That's not what religions used to be. It's what they have sometimes, for some people, become. If we want to look at the whole panoply, we should look at the religions which still have agent gods, supernatural agent gods, and those that don't. One sees the fossil traces of all that agency in every religion. I think it is the most important uniting feature of all the things we call religions. It's also true that many of those religions have become effectively annihilated. The agency has been draining out of them, and we're now left with what we might call former religions.
I'm not sure where Buddhism fits in there. Buddhism, it seems to me, that's a religion with a long, long history, which has never had supernatural agency. But
we could have
an argument about the practice of Buddhism as opposed to the belief.
Every religion has its Unitarians, its elite sophisticates who love the themes and don't like the supernatural side, and so they leave it out.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's going to work on Buddhism. But anyway, Alistair, there was
I wanted to say how much I appreciate that response, but I do want to respond to it.
Okay. Yeah. I also wondered if you could pick up a particular point that Dan made, which I wanted to have your insight on. Sorry, can you hear me a bit better? There was just one point that I wanted Alistair to pick up on, which was this idea Islam is submission, and the idea of surrender, which is very important in the Christian tradition as well, the idea of surrender to the will of God. And I wondered how you would respond to Dan on
that
issue.
I can't and shouldn't speak for Islam. I'm a Christian, and therefore it would be important to do that. The idea is there in sections of Christianity, in late medieval mysticism, Meister Eckhart, the idea of gelassenheit. But it's always this idea that there is this belief in God which is seen as the one thing in life that really is worthwhile and may be trusted. And therefore, if you're going to submit yourself to anyone, and we all exist in networks of submission and relationships, that is the way these things work, then the point being made is simply, if there's anyone who has who is worth submitting to, it is God. So it's that kind of idea, the recognition that there is something here about this agent and about no other, which might merit you orientating yourself towards that agent in how you behave and indeed how you think.
It seems to me, sorry, can you hear me properly? Can you hear the microphone? No. Comes and goes. Sorry, I'll speak up, but it just seems to me that this concept of surrender is not just a late medieval mysticism idea. You'll get it in Rick Warren, The Purpose-Driven Life. You get it in all kinds of Christianity, all expressions of Christianity. And it is, I think, probably one of the things that most puts off agnostics, atheists.
Well, let me come back to it then. I mean, it's certainly find much of, you find Augustine, for example, talks about the service of God being absolute freedom. But the point that Augustine is trying to make is that we exist in a network of relationships where, whether we like it or not, we are either exploiters or being exploited. And what Augustine is trying to explain, maybe he explains it imperfectly, is that in his view, God is the one who engenders within us a way of acting, a way of living, which actually liberates us from other lesser entanglements. So there's a very strong sense that this is about we all exist in some relationship, dependency, some relationship. We're not totally autonomous. I mean, the Enlightenment vision, I think, is very difficult to sustain. What Augustine is saying is that this is a liberating relationship. But in any relationship, there's got to be some other person you're relating to. And for Augustine, it is by this relationship with God that you bring about the spiritual liberation, which is so important for him.
The trouble with that, I think, is that that same liberation is seen by so many as liberating them from the normal constraints of decency to each other. To me, one of the most dangerous ideas in religion is the idea that your allegiance to your God liberates you from the sense of common decency towards other human beings who may not share your faith. This has certainly been a major source of the difficulties in perhaps not all typical religion, but when religions go toxic, it is typically because the people have got it into their head that behavior that they would otherwise view as completely abhorrent is justified because they've been liberated from the constraints of society by their faith in their idea.
Well, how do you respond to that? I mean, for me, as someone who's read the history of the 20th century, one of the greatest sadnesses and even one of the greatest paradoxes is that some of the worst excesses were committed by those who believed that the elimination of religion was the best way ahead to securing a better world. I think that the truth of this matter is there is fault on all sides. And I'm certainly very happy to own up to any problems my side has had and work to do something about it. But I think there needs to be honesty all round on this front. Can I go back to the meme? Because that is something I would like to talk about.
Briefly, because I think the meme, in a way, is a well-trodden debate. And perhaps there are other areas of this which are more kind of novel. But if you wanted just briefly, and then I've got one last question before we...
In 1 minute. I mean, I studied neo-Darwinism. It's compelling all the way from Mendel through to the existence of DNA, to its apparent structure, to its clarification of the genetic role. I mean, I am forced by the evidence to say that's the way it is, and that's it. I don't see any evidence for this meme. It's being generalized in terms of ideas, in terms of words. It is so vague as to be undefinable and unrefinable, and therefore I have real problems with it.
Was there anything in the evolution of religion, which there's much more detail in the book than Dan had time for, but the way in which shamanism, divination, ancestor worship, these were the sort of raw materials that got built up into, you know, domesticated, institutionalized religion. Were there any points in that explanation which you found intellectually robust enough?
I would have liked to have seen something else. I would have liked to have seen, for example, looking at the history of one religion and saying, look, at this point we can see this, at this point, because it's documented. My real concern is that I did not see a robust engagement with history. It seemed to me to be slightly speculative. I would dearly have loved to Professor Dennett have said, right, let's take a single case study, go for it, and really try and explain it, because then it would be much easier to have a discussion. But I fear that I just didn't find the raw material for that kind of engagement I really would have liked.
I think what Dan's trying to do is stimulate precisely those kinds of research.
And I would want to say that the next thing should be a case studies, we can check out whether this works or not.
Yeah, it could be a lifetime's work doing every religion, trying to see if it matches up. Okay, I'm sure there's lots of people that want to make comments and questions. If you could be as concise as possible. There's mics on either side of the room, and I will try and catch your eye. There's very bright light, so forgive me. There's a gentleman right at the back. We'll take two or three questions at a time. So if the speakers could just make a note of questions to come back to them. The gentleman at the back, and then there was somebody over on this side. There's a gentleman there. Yeah.
My name is Nico Heller. Question really for both speakers, and the same question really. Is it possible to think and to theorize about such a thing as religion from the outside? I mean, can an atheist really, I mean, really have an opinion on religion, or would that not be something that could really only be fully understood by having faith?
Okay, the gentleman over there. Is there any more hands? There's some in the middle. So perhaps a mic could move over into the middle over there. At the back. Is there a gentleman at the back? Yeah.
My name is John Meakin. Perhaps my question is a little similar. And that is, I'd like to hear whether the two gentlemen here think that science and religion are in any way compatible. Because it seems to me that on the one hand, we tend to link all religion in a bad category and all science in a good category. Whereas I think there is good religion and bad religion, and there is good science and there is definitely not so good science. Are they in any way compatible? And because over the last few weeks and months particularly, we've had a huge amount of raging debate on television, notably with Richard Dawkins, in which the whole situation has been heavily polarised.
Yeah, I think my comment relates actually to the previous two questions, and it's an issue that the Reverend brought up, Professor Alistair Walter, in his talk, which was when he was describing atheism as a meme much like religion. And it relates to both these questions, because there was an assumption there that one can't understand the debate if you're on the atheistic side. One can't understand how a religious person can hold that meme. And it's precisely because memes should be subject to counterattack and subject to a process of defense, whereas the religious meme says, oh, well, it's about faith. So it's got a kind of inbuilt self-defense mechanism that resists any of that kind of attack. And I think that was exposed by the previous two questions.
Right. Because of these questions are quite a similar theme, perhaps we'll see if we can... There's a gentleman in the middle over here. Anybody else got a point? Stunned into silence.
So, my name is David Wood, Fellow of the Royal Society. I have a question for Professor McGrath. Clearly you think that the explanations of religion given in Professor Dennett's book don't apply to your own religion because your own religion is reasonable and you have good scientific reasons, whatever, for believing it. But do you concede that some of these explanations might apply to some of the other, no doubt, wacky religions and crazy beliefs about the supernatural that people have? After all, not all the beliefs are compatible or consistent, so we need some other account for these other beliefs. So do you concede that any of these explanations might be valid in at least these cases?
Why don't we start with that last question, Alistair?
Thank you very much for that question. It's a good question. I think I'm puzzled by Professor Dennett's model of religion. Religion is a very complex entity indeed. And it has ideas, but it also has narratives, it has values, it has rituals, it has structures. And one has to use a multi-layered approach to make sense of this. I personally find Roy Baskar's approach, set out, for example, the possibility of natural and others, the idea of stratification, different levels, with a non-reductionist interaction between them. Now, as I was reading Professor Dennett's book, my question was really, at what level is he aiming? Is he aiming at a level of ideas? What is the level to which he is doing this? And certainly, for example, if you look at the evolution, I use that word perfectly happily, or, for example, religious ritual, you can see developments that are shaped by the environment. But it's not uniform. For example, Islam and Christianity are very, very different. I generalize, but Islam on the whole tends to resist cultural assimilation. Christianity thinks it's a good idea because they have very different understandings of what God is all about. So certainly, there is something here, and that's why I think it's so good to begin this discussion. But I don't think it's actually at the level that Professor Dennett thinks it is. And that's why I think, we need more reflection on this. In my own case, I'm a Protestant Christian, and Protestantism in effect came into being because it felt there was a need for self-reflection and critique. And I represent that strand. It is extremely self-critical and prepared to reject what's wrong, hold on to what's good. So I'm very happy to be stimulated to have this discussion. But again, I just think that religion is very, very difficult to define. In fact, I go further than that and say it actually, as a category, religion really, I think, is a product of the universalizing tendencies of the Enlightenment, which actually wanted everything to be pretty much the same. And I just don't think that works. I don't think there is a single definition of religion, which is why I'm pressing Professor Dent a little bit. I think actually there are individual religions, and we've just got to learn to live with that. There may actually not be a single unifying definition that actually holds them together at all.
Are there any other points that you wanted to pick up from...
Well, I will, but then I must make way for Professor Dennett. Very briefly, if I may, two points. One is science and religion, are they compatible? Well, clearly, they are both such broad categories that actually it's extremely difficult to generalise. What I would want to say is you'll find religionists who are excruciatingly rude about science and ignorant of its methods. You'll find scientists who are excruciatingly rude about religion and ignorance of its beliefs. That's just the way life is, I fear. But I think there is a habitable in-between zone, which I think merits further exploration. That's why I would certainly place myself. I would certainly say that in recent years there's growing interest in this, partly because it's just seen as being so significant. So I think there is room for further advance, but there are debates that need to happen along the way. Question back there, basically, I think the implication of the question was that somehow religious memes are sort of way so well defended they don't critique themselves, whereas everybody else's memes are, you know, basically subject to rational belief. I have difficulty with that. A, because I believe that question to show the self-referential paradox. In other words, my ideas are rational, yours are not. Well, actually, all of us are caught up in a matrix of complex factors that need to be more carefully examined. But again, I mean, my conversion was purely intellectual. Purely intellectual. I was an atheist, believing it offered the best explanation of all things. I became a Christian believing it offered a best explanation. So either my atheist memes or my Christian memes were faulty at some point, but I believe the same argument would actually apply to whichever state you chose to look at. I think my real concern is that some people use memes in a way that somehow seems to override the basic idea of rationality. And I find that quite puzzling. I don't think Professor Dennett does that, but I think that may have been implicit in the question.
Dan.
Let me deal with those questions in turn. Can we study religions from the outside? I think absolutely yes, and I think it is the claim that we can't, which is very familiar coming from many people in many religions, that you have to have faith in order to study faith. This is, I think, simply an unacceptable defense mechanism which must be rejected out of hand. There is absolutely no reason why... It reminds me of the claim that some feminists make that only women can study women. We would never let bankers say, you have to be a plutocrat to study bankers. We would never let actually musicians say, you have to be a fine musician to study music. And we shouldn't permit the religious to say, if you don't have faith, you can't study us. In fact, in my book, I propose recognizing that ignorant study of religion is not a good idea. I propose, I have a modest proposal. Let the religious leaders in any religion who are leery of letting scientists study their religion, let them set a really demanding entrance exam in all of their beliefs and all of their rituals. And they can give it, they can describe, they can set this exam themselves and they can grade it themselves. And any scientist who wants to study religion who can't pass the exam is excluded from cooperation. However, they also have to give that same exam to some of their own priests and they have to be blind graded. I submit that this will deal with that problem quite satisfactorily. Whether science and religion are compatible, it's not a question of whether they're compatible. I'm not saying that science should do what religion does. I'm saying science should study what religion does. And science can study what religion does, whether it's compatible or not. Religion is a phenomenon in the world. It's many phenomena, as Alistair says. It's a very complex matter. Science is used to studying very complex matters. The biosphere is very complex. There's many, many different species. There are many, many different species of religion. Absolutely. They differ in all sorts of interesting regards. If you really want to understand that complexity, instead of just glorying in it and saying, oh, it's much too complex to study, you study it scientifically and you begin to eke out taxonomies and you try different taxonomies and you see what makes the taxonomies hold up better than others. And indeed, we'll find former religions, we'll find assimilations, we'll find things that didn't seem similar at first, which now turn out to be very similar. We'll find things which looked very close at first, turn out to be really very different. That's what you learn when you adopt a rigorous scientific attitude. The fellow at the back who talked about inbuilt defense mechanisms. That's, I think, one of the things that I'm particularly pleased with in the book is that I describe a variety of defense mechanisms which have evolved over time. They've evolved culturally. This is not in your genes. These are good tricks. They are ways that religions protect themselves from rational scrutiny and from other threats. And the people who employ these tricks do not have to understand them. They did not design them themselves. They did not figure out why they work. They don't have to. They are simply the beneficiaries of these strategies, in the same way that the cuckoo is a beneficiary of the strategy of pushing the egg out of the nest. Now, for the cuckoo, that's in the genes. In human beings, it's in the memes. You don't have to understand it. You don't have to have figured it out yourself. But you do have to have been implanted with that idea by your co-religionists. And that's why you say the things that you say.
I'm very glad you raised the issue about the exam, because it was one of the things I had meant to tackle you on this morning. If you study a religion from the outside, which I would agree with you, entirely justified and legitimate exercise to do, but inevitably there are going to be points of not understanding or of missing something. And the idea that an exam would be an appropriate test of understanding a religion completely horrified me. I just thought, Dan really hasn't got it. That bit there, I thought, he really doesn't understand that a faith can be a lived experience. It's not a body of knowledge on which you can be tested. It's a living experience, which perhaps may be something that you accumulate, experience at different times in different ways.
I learned a few years ago, to my amazement, that when young composers submit pieces in composition, music composers submit pieces to be judged for prizes, typically, it's changing now, alas, typically, instead of submitting, say, a tape or a CD, they submit the score. And the judges silently read the scores and judge first place, second place, third place on the basis of their silent reading of the scores. And I thought, boy, I can read music, but I can't do that. And I marveled at the capacity of composers being able to read scores at that level of acuity and to capture what was going on in the music well enough to make confident and agreed upon judgments. Now, I quite agree with you that faith can be a matter of a life lived. I do not agree with you that we can't study that in the same way that composers can study scores. You don't have to hear the music to judge it.
You can study it. I'm saying, can you test it in the way that you were describing it and in an examination? Alistair, were you wanting to...
I was just intrigued by this. First of all, I thought it was a very good question. I'm very interested indeed by your answer. But again, if I can just go back to something I noticed when I was younger. I mean, when I was an atheist, I mean, I was looking at Christianity from the outside. And I saw people not doing certain things, which I thought actually might be quite interesting, and being forced to do things which seemed to me deadly dull. And I couldn't see for the life of me why they were doing that. And I think it's only later I discovered a kind of animating factor, a sort of inner propensity which drove them to do that. And so in terms of watching something from outside, it's like watching a play. You see people moving, but you don't get the plot. It is a very complex thing. I think you're right to say one must be able to judge, must be able to analyze, but there's always the risk that there's a lack of sort of intellectual empathy, if you like, with what might be going on beneath the surface.
That's true. That's a risk. But there's also a risk, especially if you're inside, of overlooking the other explanation, which might be that, I mean, first of all, I would submit that just as when you speak your language, you don't know how you make up sentences. You have no inkling as to how you parse sentences, how you know which sentences are grammatical and which not. If you want to study that, you study it with linguistics. And it might also be true that the very behaviors that you are marveling at from the inside have an explanation that's completely alien to you, which you dislike intensely, and yet it is true. That is one of the things that science can do.
I think we've got time for another round of questions before the speakers sum up. There was a gentleman right at the back that I did indicate towards. Where's he gone?
I'd like to turn this...
Hang on one second, and then there was somebody in the middle, and then somebody down here at the front afterwards.
Could we perhaps turn the house lights up?
Yeah, can we turn the house lights up? Is there anybody around who can hear me? No. Sorry, Dan.
I'd like to ask the same question, but turn it on its head. Can a scientist ever be outside the experiment or outside the sphere of observation? In other words, is there such a thing as this kind of true, impartial observer, that sort of like, you know, archetypical positivist scientist? And if so, how would that scientist, what would that scientist look like?
Mm-hmm. Question over there.
This is a question to Professor McGrath. Do you find it significant that the word religion is hardly ever used in the New Testament? I think it's only ever used either of the, what you might loosely call the pagan religions, or in the letter of James, I think it's used of what is essentially a first-generation Christian Judaism. But you wouldn't find it, for example, in St. Paul's writings, I think, and I don't think you'd find it in the Gospels. Now, do you think that has any significance? And if so, in relation to this discussion, what is that significance?
The gentleman here at the front, if you could pass the mic over, please. Thanks. And if the mic can get down here, there was somebody here. Put your hand up so the mic person can see you. And please, put your hand up if you have any other questions. I'm keen to get as many as possible.
On the assumption that there is one eternal God, just one, been there forever, it does puzzle me, and I'm just wondering what the two panelists think, why has one God brought different religions, Buddhism, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and the different sects within all these religions? Why has he confused all of us by bringing these different religions, and yet there's one eternal God?
Great.
I find it very puzzling.
Good question. Someone over here.
You're using the idea of means to undermine religion, but in doing so, aren't you also undermining your own ideas? If memes are ideas for themselves, then they're not about truth. If they're about themselves, then they're not about truth.
Question here.
I just wanted to raise the question of faith. I wondered whether, and I suppose it's addressed to Professor Dennett, whether... We aren't talking of a completely different phenomenon. You mentioned the fact that many religions ask us to submit to God. That, of course, is very similar to the marriage ritual as traditionally conceived. You promise to love, honour and obey. In other words, you submit to another person. And this is regarded as a kind of existential change. You're not now the same person after that commitment as you were before. And most religions... also think that faith is like that, that there is an existential change. You're a different kind of person. This isn't a meme in this. You seem to think that all ideas are memes, but it is not like suddenly grasping Gödel's theorem or coming to understand at last the Wagner operas. This is a transformation of the personality, and I'd suggest that there's something more to this phenomenon than just the action of a meme on the intellect.
Any other comments or questions? No. Great. I'm wondering who wants the last word.
Well,
all right, Dan.
I'm ready to go. Let me take those questions in turn. Can a scientist get outside of science was the first question. And the answer is, in a certain sense, is no, but science has dealt with that. We know that individual scientists are biased and hopeful, and that they can't be trusted to be objective, and that's why science has all of these built-in systems to protect scientists from their own subjectivity. That's why we do double-blind experiments. That's why we have peer review. Scientists are just as fallible as anybody else. And they can get their heads in awful twists because they are so eager to have their hypotheses proven. That's why they have devised all these impersonal methods for protecting them from their own credulity. And it's interesting that religion doesn't have anything that's remotely like that. Now, on the question of faith. Several people. Oh, you want to just
come back? I'll come back.
I think come back at the end.
I'll come back.
Right. One of the interesting things about the concept of faith, or I will say the meme of faith, is it absolutely doesn't exist in any folk religion. People who are engaged in folk religions don't even realize they're engaging in a religion. They don't have a concept of religion. They don't think of it as a religion. It's just part of what everybody knows in the local group. It's completely continuous with their folk science, just the lore that everybody knows. The very idea of faith is a late development in the evolution of religion that's only found in some religions, and it is a particularly adaptive meme of the Abrahamic religions, and that's an interesting fact about it. As to the question of how it's on the assumption there's one God, why did that God permit all these different religions to flourish? Well, I guess it was a test of faith, wasn't it?
Just to respond to some of these, I mean, religion does try very, very hard to validate its ideas through debate. In the case of Protestantism, it's through the idea of the priesthood of all believers, which means there is no elite. Everyone has a say in trying to work out whether this idea is right, whether this is actually a legitimate interpretation of the Bible. It is about a deprofessionalization of the entire debate. It's not a sort of exclusive group who make decisions. It's everyone. So I think there is a mechanism there. The point about the New Testament, I think there is a very important point there. The New Testament doesn't really use the word religion at all. It's not a New Testament word, really, in any sense of the word. The fundamental theme is faith. Faith is understood as a relational thing, not primarily a cognitive thing at all. It's this relationship that's established, and that then radiates outwards into how you behave, how you worship, and so on. And as you will know, writers like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Karl Barth would say that religion may be stripped away, and faith is what's left behind, and that's what really matters. It accretes a religion, in other words, as a snowball might accrete further layers, but actually the real heart of the matter is this thing called faith. And again, that's why I'd love to see a much more nuanced understanding of what religion actually is, because it seems to me that is very, very significant here. The point about memes, well, my problem is that, again, I simply do not see the evidence for that. I mean, Professor Dennett says that Simon Conway Morris's critique may be set to one side. As far as I'm concerned, it's still on the table, because there is this question, how on earth do we make rational adjudications in a communal sense if there are these things called memes? And it seems to me that raises some very interesting questions, which makes the idea of memes actually dispensable. And therefore, I think there's a further discussion to be had here. So it seems to me that that is really a very important point to take further. But the final point I want to make in response to questions from the back is, it seems to me there's a very interesting question here, not so much about scientific subjectivity, but actually as to whether there are limits to the scientific method. In other words, whether there are going to be some things which actually, by their very nature, lie beyond what science can tell us. For example, what is the point of life? Or another question, is democracy better than fascism? I mean, these are live issues. And it's no criticism of science, I think, to say there may be limits to what it's saying. It's simply a question of working out what those limits are and working within them. My problem simply is with those who press way beyond them and then call the results science.
Well, that's an extremely thought-provoking evening. It's time to draw it to a close. Just briefly, on the religion point, my understanding is religion wasn't really used as a word until the Enlightenment.
It's a Latin word, religio, meaning things that bind people together.
Yes.
And primarily designated the Roman cult, which gave the Roman state a sense of identity.
But did they use the word religion?
Lucretius does. It's used, but it became the preferred word for what we observe.
Yeah. So many, many thanks for coming. Many thanks to Dan and to Alistair for an absolutely fascinating evening, which I suspect if ever anybody else is like me, will be going away and thinking about many of the issues that have come up this evening for a long time to come. I do urge you to buy the books. They're outside, and you'll have plenty more to think about after you've read them. So many, many thanks for coming, and many thanks to Dan and Alistair.